Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Before we get stuck into a handful of recent DN posts, Andrew, I just wanted to tell our wonderful podcast audience that DN is now on Patreon.
Woo!
it took us 2 years to get up on there, but we've finally done it. For people that don't know, Patreon is a platform that allows, and it's a horrible term, but it does apply, content creators like us to invite their audiences to contribute a small amount of money each month just to help make whatever it is that content creator does more sustainable, short-term and long-term. And that's how it applies to us, really. We're inviting anyone who wants to contribute to DN, to making it more sustainable now, and to allow Andrew and I to make it bigger and better in the future, to do so. People can choose how much or how little they want to contribute, and in return, all our patrons are going to get weekly articles from Andrew and I, exclusively. There'll be weekly articles that we'll do reviews, we'll do opinion pieces, we'll do features similar to the stuff that we do on Instagram. But these will be a bit longer and a bit more in-depth and for patrons only. So if anyone does want to contribute, go along to patreon.com/DriveNation and you'll find us there. If you're minded to, if you can afford to, we'd be so grateful for any support that you can give. Anything to add, Andrew?
Well, only that, just so people understand where we are. If you follow us on Instagram, you will have seen a few sponsored posts and that sort of thing. So you will be aware that DN is earning a little bit of money, but it's not a free thing for us to do. We have to promote stuff. We have to buy in stuff. And just so you know that to date, although we're nearly 2 years in, Dan and I have yet to see a single penny out of the business. So we're not paying our ourselves. We are still doing this absolutely free, gratis, and for nothing, and because we love it. So you know, you're not really, you know, what we're asking is really for an investment in DN. It's not investment in Dan and me. It's so that this thing, which I think we certainly love, and there are, you know, certainly tens of thousands of other people out there who seem to appreciate it, it's just so that we can keep on doing it. And it's as simple as that. So if you can support us on Patreon, Dan and I would be absolutely chuffed to bits.
Yeah, it's patreon.com/DriveNation. You'll also find a link directly there in our bio on our Instagram page at DriveNation_. And yeah, to everybody who has pledged so far, thank you so much. It's enormously humbling. Fine, well, that's that done. Shall we
promo over?
Exactly. Let's crack on and let's talk about the biggest story, the biggest post on DN in the past week or so, and very sadly, Andrew, it's the passing of Hans Metzger, the revered Porsche engineer.
Yeah, you see, I just wonder whether, you know, outside the world of you know, diehard car enthusiast, DNers and everything. That's just how revered he is. I mean, I think there are lots of people out there who've probably heard of, you know, the Colombo engines in Ferraris and Lampredi engines and that sort of thing. But I just wonder whether Metzger ever got the worldwide recognition as one of the absolute all-time great engineers of this business that, you know, that his achievements deserve. And it's, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, I just posted a little piece on DN when we heard that he'd sadly passed away at the age of 90. The response has just been amazing. And I think among those who know, you know, the greatest engineer of our era. I mean, you know, you could say Ferdinand Piëch, because, you know, Metzger and him worked hand in hand, side by side for many, many years. And it's quite hard to divorce the work of one from the other. But yeah, I mean, he's right up there, isn't he?
Yeah, there's no question about it. He was also part of that cabal of engineers and Porsche folk who started at the company in the very, very early days in the 50s. And then just didn't go anywhere. They stuck around. And it must have been an extraordinary thing to witness firsthand. This company going from, you know, a small sports car maker building 356s, progressing through the 60s, 70s, 80s and so on, watching it win Le Mans countless times, watching it really take over the sports car world.
Absolutely.
Particularly with the 911. What a thing to have observed firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, for him, you know, for given his involvement in the 911, to see that, you know, that little overhead cam 2 litre flat six that he was so involved with. And again, I don't think many people realise Metzger was absolutely integral to the, you know, everybody thinks about the Metzger engine, which I'm sure we'll come to later on in the podcast. But, you know, he was there at the get go. And this little engine that he, as I say, he was, you know, whose design he was integral to. And just to see, you know, up until, you know, his death, whatever it was, you know, 57 years later, you know, a flat six engine still being in the back of a 911. He must have been chuffed by that every time he saw one growl past in the street. And then, I mean, the stuff that he did between those poles. And as you say, you know, coming to Porsche as a man in his, well, he was actually in his late 20s, wasn't he, in the late 1950s. And here was this still very little company making 356s and, you know, sort of 550 Spider race cars. And then, you know, within a decade, you got a 917. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary. And, you know, and I think you could absolutely, I mean, for instance, one of the things that he was very involved with, this isn't very well known, the engine that went into the 911 wasn't the one that was originally designed for it. In the 1950s, as they were working on this car, they designed it was an air-cooled flat six, but it had push rods. It had very long push rods, which if that engine had made it into production, the engine would never have revved. You could never have tuned it. You certainly couldn't have raced it. And the entire history of Porsche might have been, you know, rather different. And, you know, Metzger was one of the guys who took a look at this engine when he turned on and just went, hang on, you know, if it has to have two camshafts, why not just put them where they're meant to be and stick them in the cylinder heads? And they did, and that engine was born, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, a hell of a legacy that he had,
yeah,
wasn't it? Can you remember off the top of your head, Andrew, how soon after joining Porsche was he put in charge of the racing division?
I don't know. Oh, well, I don't know, I'm afraid, off the top of my head, the exact date that he turned up, but I think it was very late in the 1950s, maybe 59, something like that. And we know that the first thing that he became known for, even before the 911 engine, was working on the air-cooled flat eight engine that was used in the 804 Grand Prix car, the car that won the 1962 French Grand Prix with Dan Gurney driving it, then and now the one and only World Championship Grand Prix that a Porsche has ever won. So he did that. He then went and worked on the 911 engine, and then in 1965, you know, the sort of proper racing department that we know of, which built all those crazy space frame cars from then on. So like after the 904, but from the 906 onwards, yeah, he and Piëch went and headed up that department. And from there on in, you know, right up until, you know, his retirement in the early 1990s, you know, he was the man. He wasn't the only man, but if there was one man who could call himself the man, I guess it was Metzger.
Yeah, absolutely. What's his overarching achievement, though? I mean, Is it the TAG Formula One engine that won so many races with McLaren? Is it that 901 engine that ultimately became the 911 engine? Or is it the 917 and Porsche's first two outright victories at Le Mans?
Well, I mean, overarching achievement. I think his achievement is, so this is an ultimate cop-out answer to your question, is the excellence that he applied to absolutely everything that he did. You know, if you look at, I just want to think of an example. You take the first 917 engine, okay? It came out in 1969, 4.5 litres. It had 580 horsepower. As long as you didn't over-rev it, it was pretty much bomb-proof. Okay, now that was a 4.5 litre engine with two valves per cylinder because it was air cooled. There wasn't enough space to cool the heads with four valves per cylinder, so they were very restricted on the cylinder head design. And, you know, you look at the Ferrari engine that Maranello created to rival it, the 5 litre, so a bigger engine, V12 with four valve heads that went into the 512S. That had about 540, 550 horsepower. So, you know, a bigger engine with, you know, four valve cylinder heads, and a Ferrari engine, and it never got near what Metzger managed to achieve, you know, with air cooling, two valves per cylinder and a smaller engine. So, and they were just so reliable. You know, the 917-30 engine, the 1100 horsepower monster that totally and utterly dominated Can-Am in 72 and 73. I mean, they just never went wrong. And you look at the domination of the 956s and the 962s in Group C in the 1980s. You know, what is the outstanding characteristic? I mean, they didn't go wrong, but they were so reliable. They were just better than everything else. They were faster. They were more reliable. They even worked out how to make them use less fuel because, you know, Group C was very much a fuel efficiency formula. And so Justin Orley, the answer to your question is what was his contribution? It was just excellence in everything he did, from a little 2 litre flat six in 1963 to, you know, the Metzger engine that went out of production with a 4 litre 997 GT3 RS in whenever it was, 2011, I think. I mean, what a legacy. Extraordinary.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable, isn't it? Okay, it's also true though that he had responsibility not just for the 917's engine but for the project overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all those cars, you know, when he went to the racing department in 65, he didn't go there just to, you know, to make engines. You know, all those amazing cars, you know, the 906, the 907, the 908, the insane 909 Berg Spider, the 910. Obviously the 917, I mean, they were, again, you know, you can't say that they were all his work, but, you know, they were all done on his watch. And in their way, I mean, they took Porsche from being a sort of bit player competing for, you know, class honours, to the most revered, successful manufacturer of sports racing cars in the world. And as I said earlier, it's not fair to say it was all Metzger, but it's certainly also not fair to say it was all Piëch. You know, between them and with everybody else, they made history. They absolutely made history, and they put Porsche's name on a map in a way that I'm sure, you know, back at the start of that decade, you know, Ferry Porsche couldn't have imagined.
So what we now need to address, Andrew, is the fact that you being perhaps the most fortunate person I know, you've driven 917s more than once.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to give us a couple of minutes now on what that experience is like, because having not done so myself, wow, I just can't imagine.
Okay. So these things, they all depend on the environment. And there have been other racing cars I've driven where, you know, you've had a very understandably nervous owner who says, oh, no more than this number of revs, no more than that number of laps. You've got to keep off the curbs. You can't, you know, push hard or anything. I feel as lucky to have been allowed to drive both 917s as hard as I liked, as I feel lucky to have driven a 917. Because to have gotten into a 917 and not been able to drive it properly, I always sort of make the analogy of taking the cork out of a bottle of, you know, Chateau Lafite and only being allowed to sniff the contents. So the first one was Richard Atwood's car. It was a long time ago at Silverstone. This it looked like the car in which he won Le Mans in 1970. It was to exactly that specification, but it was actually its sister car. So this was chassis 22, and I think 23 won the race. But it was one of the cars that was in the Le Mans Steve McQueen movie, and then got sold to Reinhold Joest, who raced it a bit. And I can just remember getting in that. And this was as cooking a 917 as you could get. 4.5 litre car, 4-speed gearbox, short tail. You know, the most boring 911.
This was the LX version, was it?
Absolutely. And it just totally and utterly blew my mind. You know, I was at Silverstone. I had the circuit to myself. The weather was lovely. It was quite cold, but we actually ran it on wets, and so you could get some heat into the tyres. And the amazing thing was, it didn't scare me. It just didn't scare me, because, you know, they'd sorted out the aero by then. I think the chassis was a bit stiffer too, and it was just the most, you know, because you know what that noise is like, because you've heard the McQueen movie, you know, you've watched the McQueen movie, and you've heard the sound, and to be in it, and it's just this sense of privilege, you can barely believe it. It's such a tiny little thing as well. They had to take the seat out for me to drive it, but that was okay. And yeah,
so what are you just sat on some tubes or something?
No, they put some foam in, so I was reasonably well located. But I can remember we were only using the national circuit, which was, so you got the old pit straight and Copse, and then, but I can remember it still did over 170 miles an hour three times a lap, ran a really short lap. And this was, you know, this was a car that was, you know, built in 1969. So yeah, I mean, the sense of occasion. And Richard Atwood, that was the other thing, Atwood was there. And his literally the only thing he was bothered about was whether I felt I'd had a proper go. And he kept on saying, yes, but have you had a proper go? And I was going, well, I think so, Richard. You know, well, get out there and try harder. He was incredible.
He's one of those former racing drivers who really gets how much people like you and I just sort of idolise that era of racing, and the guys like him who race those cars in period. He just understands it, doesn't he?
Yeah, and of course you could never have the experience, because let's not forget, when he won Le Mans in 1970, there were, what, 50, 60 other lunatics on the track. It was 24 hours, you had to race it at night, it rained most of the time. I mean, you cannot do what I did and think you have any idea at all of what he went through. But nevertheless, you've driven a 917, and Richard Atwood is there saying, get back in the car and drive it harder. And honestly, the other memory of it is just that Porsche approach, because, you know, this car is a very old car, and yet, you know, it starts with a key. No, you know, special sequence of switches and pumps to prime and widgets to do this and that and the other. You just turn it. It's like you start a 917 the same way that you start a 911 or indeed a Ford Fiesta. And, you know, Synchromesh gearbox. Yeah, because Porsche understood that, you know, easily the least reliable component in any car is the one that, you know, sits behind the steering wheel and operates it. So you make life easy for him. Proper ventilation, all that sort of stuff. They just thought of that because, you know, they realised these things had to be driven by not just professional race drivers in sprint races, but gentleman drivers who may have more money than talent, you know, over 24 hours. And yeah, so that was that. And the other one was the 917-30 at Goodwood last year. And I don't know whether I banged on about that in a podcast yet, but that was...
I don't think you have, so let's get stuck into it. So this was the 50th anniversary celebrations.
Yeah, 50th anniversary of the 917. And actually, I mean, I'd like to say they gave me the most powerful one because they thought I was a superhero. In fact, it was an entirely practical thing because they gave it to me because it was the only one which didn't have a roof, so I could stick out the top, and there was, you know, I'd have some chance of being able to drive it, because if anybody doesn't know me, I'm 6'4", so these things are always a bit of a challenge. And it wouldn't start. There were five 917s there. Dickie was in a 917-10. Harris was in the car they call the Taxi, the Gulf 917, probably the most successful of them all, which is still owned by the factory. And it's called the Taxi because they used to go and scare the wits out of, you know, visiting executives when they used to come to Vysac in the early 70s by just giving them a lift around the track in this thing. And there was, I think it was Mark Webber in the original 001 917. And they all fired up beautifully. And the 917-30, which I was to drive, which was, you know, an absolutely reliable car at any other time, just wouldn't start. And it wouldn't start. And they just tried everything. And the other cars had gone to the assembly area, and they'd spent half a day trying to get this thing to go. And in the end, I think somebody from Goodwood just turned up with a Land Rover, an old Land Rover, and a rope. And we towed it through the paddock. You know, people, I mean, it was health and safety, I mean, out the window, with, you know, people scattering left, right, and centre. And then suddenly there was this bang, which was all the stuff they'd stuck in the engine to try to get it to start all going igniting at the same time. And then after that, there it was just, it was honestly, you know, other than getting married and watching my children going, being born, it was one of the happiest moments of my life. That just hearing the sound of that 1100 horsepower, 5.4 litre flat 12 motor, happily sort of running away to itself, just warming up, and you know, butter wouldn't melt as if nothing. I mean, I'd almost had a heart attack waiting for that thing. Harris, actually, here's the mark of a true mate. I was tearing my hair out, wandering up and down this line of all these other 917s, and knowing I wasn't going to get to drive one. And Harris flipped open the door of the taxi and said, "What's the problem?" And I explained to him, and he just started undoing his belts and said, "I have this one." And I didn't, and I never would have done, and I couldn't have got into it. But instinctively, his reaction was just, "Have this one," which I just thought was amazing. Anyway, so I got in this thing, and you know, I'd spoken to a lot of people who'd driven it, and they all said one thing. And these are, you know, unlike me, proper professional racing drivers. You know, Derek Bell, Richard Atwood. I think I spoke to Dario Marino, and they all just said, "Don't worry, it's fine." And I'm going, "Yeah, really? 1100 horsepower? You know, a 917?
What space does the car frames, weigh?"
850, I think.
Oof,
I mean,
wow.
Nothing. And they just said, "Don't worry, it'll be fine." And it's just one of those cars that I wasn't out the first corner before I suddenly realized it will be fine, because it just did. It just felt what it was, which was, after it was, you know, it was in its fourth year by then, it just felt like a thoroughly developed racing car. I mean, in 1969, as I'm sure lots of people listening to this will know, I mean, the car was, you know, tricky is putting it very, very mildly indeed. I mean, some would say it was lethal. In fact, it did kill a bloke called John Wolfe, the first ever privateer driver of a 917, did get killed in one, literally on the opening lap of Le Mans in 1969. He crashed at White House. And you know, his co-driver, a bloke called Digby Martland, who's actually an old family friend of mine, had gone down there and he'd driven the thing in practice and spun it down the end of Mulsanne, and just mercifully didn't hit anything, got it back to the pits, got out the car and said, "I'm not driving this, and if you've got any sense, neither should you." And Digby went home. And so, wow. they lent John Wolfe Herbert Linger, the test driver, and they begged Wolfe to let Linger start the race, because he'd been racing Porsches at Le Mans for donkey's years. And Wolf said, "Nope, sorry, my car, my race. You know, if it goes bang, I won't get to drive it, so I'm going to start." And tragically, you know, his race and the rest of his life lasted less than one lap. But anyway, so I've got completely sidetracked. So the 30, yeah. We had, Dickie and I had a bit of a problem, in fact, in that there was another bloke there in an Interserie 9710 who appeared to either be going shopping or not know his way around Goodwood. And we'd been told that if you overtook him, it was a black flag offence, and you would literally be hauled off the track if you overtook anyone. So we spent most of our time just sort of hanging back half a lap and then, you know, giving it the beans to try and catch up with this chap. So Weber and Harris, who didn't have this problem because they'd started in front, disappeared. But I did get most of a lap driving a 917-30 as hard and as fast as I was happy to drive it. And that obviously means without taking anything that I would recognise as a risk. And I can remember the single most memorable thing was coming out the chicane at the start of this lap. And, you know, you obviously have to be very, very gentle with it. It's only got four gears, so in first and second. But coming out the chicane, accelerating hard through second, and then putting into third, I'm now basically where the sort of finish line is. So I'm getting quite near the corner at the end of the straight. I'm at the top end of third. It's probably doing 120, 130 miles an hour. And I think, okay, it'll definitely have traction now. So for the first time, I can put my foot all the way to the floor. And it just lit them up. You can just see the revs go whoop, and I can just feel the rear tires just light up at 120, 130 miles an hour in third gear.
Whoa, bloody hell! I think one or two of our friends watching from the pit wall at the time said to each other, "The clutch is slipping."
No, tire slipping. Tire slipping. And it was,
wow.
But the other thing was, it was completely undramatic. You know, if you'd said to me, "You're going to spin the wheels of a 917-30 at 120 mile, whatever," I wouldn't have got in the thing. But in fact, you know, I heard it and I saw it on the rev counter, but in the car, it was nothing. It was absolutely nothing at all.
So apart from traction and all that power in such a light car, what are you managing? What's the sort of trickiest thing to deal with around the line?
The trickiest thing is the chassis is not a problem. You'd be amazed. The car had great grip, great brakes, all that was sorted. So the only thing that you are, yeah, so I mean traction obviously, but more than anything else, you're just managing the boost. And when it's on boost, it's actually quite easy to modulate. So you've just got to keep the revs up, and you've got to accept that before the boost comes in, there's going to be a bit of a wait. And you know, it was nothing like as bad as the early turbo car, the 917-10, which was apparently a bit of a monster. And they'd really got on top of the turbocharging much better by the time the 917-30 came along. Obviously you wouldn't want all the boost to turn out halfway through a corner, but you know, you'd have to be an idiot to get yourself into that situation. It was, I suppose, to that extent, a bit of a point at squirt machine. You couldn't balance it like you'd want to, like you'd be able to balance a, you know, a sports car 917. God, I sound like I'm some kind of expert in this. I'm not. I'm just an idiot who's driven this thing for a few laps. But yeah,
it's more than I've done. It's fascinating to hear anyway.
But the thing is that you have to think about all this stuff if you're not going to crash the car. You know, you're not sitting there thinking, I'm going to break the lap record, I'm going to impress a load of people. You're just thinking, don't crash the car. Because in me, you know, even if it didn't technically end your career, I would be so ashamed of myself. I'd walk away from the business. I could never be.
You'd have to end it yourself, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was that. Yes, and that was obviously Metzger's engine.
Bloody hell, that's incredible. His that amazing engine in that incredible car, and you're so fortunate to have driven the 917 a couple of times.
Yes, but I don't. But when I was your age, I hadn't driven one. So there's time yet.
There is hope. There is hope yet. Okay. Well, you did mention it a little earlier on. There's another engine that is actually called the Metzger engine, which has nothing to do with 917s. It's actually the flat six that it was in the GT1 car originally. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's based on all sorts of things. I mean, you know, people sort of think that someone just sits down and thinks, I'll do an engine now. That's not actually what happens. You look at what you've got and you use components from here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, its origins go back to, you know, the 959 and the 956, and the idea of having water-cooled cylinder heads for those cars. And it kind of evolved. But I think sort of in sort of common parlance, most people think of the 911 GT1, which was the sort of, there were bits of 911 in it, certainly in the front end. It was the sort of mid-engine prototype with which Porsche contested Le Mans as a factory team in 96, 97, and actually won it in 98. And so that has the sort of, it's the engine with the proper dry sump, with the, you know, the external oil tank, not a sort of split sump, you know, sitting at the bottom of the engine. And then obviously it became famous because that was the engine that provided the basis of the GT3, the 996 GT3 in whenever that was, 1999, I think.
Yeah, and it continued to be used by that sort of GT3, GT3 RS dynasty, right up, as you said, up until the RS 4 litre in 2011.
Yeah, and the irony being, you know, by the time the first of these cars, by the first Porsche GT1 had appeared in 1990, Metzger had already retired. You know, so it is his engine, but, you know, it is amazing how it was so good. That it just lived on. And the reason it was so good, and I remember talking to Andy Preuninger, who many of you will know is the kind of, you know, the engineering guru at Weissach, who is, you know, the man. He's kind of Mr. GT3. And saying to him, you know, why are you still using this old engine when Porsche keep on making all these new flats? And he said, well, because it's the Metzger engine. He said, it is so strong. It is so high developed. It was so brilliantly conceived from the get-go. I mean, to the extent, why wouldn't you use it? You know, we know it inside out. We know what we can do to it. We know we haven't got to the limit of its capability. So they just kept on using it. And clever old them, because as we know, Porsche did some, you know, a non-Metzger, very much a non-Metzger engine for, you know, the normal 996s and 997s, as you know, lots of people listening to this will know, you know, they have problems with intermediate shafts and rear main oil seals and goodness knows what.
Bore scoring as well.
Yeah, exact bore scoring as well. But if you had a GT3 or in fact a turbo, because the 996 and I think just the first generation of 997 turbos, they're all Metzger engines too. And they don't have any of those problems, funnily enough.
It's incredible, isn't it? And you were talking earlier about a certain era of Porsche competition cars combining, like nothing else, huge power and performance with durability.
Yeah.
And they're the same attributes that...
100%.
...that were in that Metzger engine many, many years later.
Yeah, yeah. And when, you know, if you remember when Porsche did the 991 GT3... which was the first GT and GT3 engine not to be a Metzger engine. You know, they had some issues with that, didn't they? And it's an amazing engine now, and all power to them. But I think it just goes to show how difficult it is to do that sort of engine to the standard that you know, that Metzger was just able to, you know, arrive at through his own genius.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that, yeah, the thing about that engine in 4 litre guise, as it was in that run out GT3 RS, with 500 horsepower from a 4 litre six cylinder normally aspirated engine. I mean, it's extraordinary for that to be in any way reliable, isn't it? It's a remarkable feat. Okay, well, we'll talk about something else in a moment, but to finish off this chat about Hans Metzger, I just want to ask what you think about this, Andrew, because I mean, he's such a highly regarded engineer, and he has effectively an engine named after him. Yes. And I just wonder if we're going to see his like again. I mean, are any of today's engineers going to be sort of revered in the same way? I mean, you've mentioned Andy Preuninger. I suppose that there's a chance, and Wallisser as well. There are also sort of high-profile test and development drivers like Matt Becker and Chris Goodwin. But I don't get the sense that we'll be putting those guys up on a pedestal quite like we have done Hans Metzger.
I know what you mean. I think there are a few reasons for that. I think there's a sort of a corporate culture issue. I think companies tend to be more collegiate in their approaches, particularly to publicising individuals. So more people tend, I think the credit tends to get shared around more people. But I think the business of engine design is just so immensely complex now, in a way it simply wasn't back in Metzger's day, with all the compliance, all the emissions, all the homologation, all this stuff. You know, you couldn't just say, you know, this is Fred's engine, because, you know, Fred's probably an army of people. But I do wonder whether people will come to recognise that actually having an engine named after a person and having that kind of revered quality about it actually isn't such a bad thing for your brand as a whole. You know, we think of Ferrari, don't we? Think of Colombo engines and Lampredi engines and that sort of thing, and they're all part and part of the Ferrari mystique. But I can't see it. I just think that time possibly has gone.
I do tend to agree with you. Okay, well, there we go. From the sublime Hans Metzger's career and his extraordinary contribution to competition cars.
I know where you're going with this.
To the ridiculous. I want to talk. I wrote a piece about the new BMW 4 Series and what I consider to be an offensively ugly front grille. I mean...
Come on, tell us what you really mean, Dan.
There we go. As I wrote in that piece, I actually didn't really want to get drawn into that whole conversation, because I just get the sense that BMW's designers are trying to be provocative and they want people to, you know, debate the merits of their work and all this sort of stuff. And I just find, I feel like I've bitten, basically. I took the bait and I've bitten. But it got to a point where I just couldn't help myself, because I'm sort of so offended by that enormous two-part front grille. I think it looks terrible. Even worse, actually, when there's a number plate slapped across it, because...
Ah, okay, that's interesting.
You think it looks better, don't you?
I thought it was so bad that anything that sort of gets rid of a bit of it and sort of divides it, bisects it, makes it, but you actually think that makes it look worse.
Well, I'm not sure if it looks better or worse, but I think it indicates to me that it almost says that they forgot there was supposed to be a number plate there, or they were sort of so determined to press on with this divisive design that it didn't matter to them that actually people are only ever going to see it with a number plate slapped across it. I get worked up about all this stuff.
Do you think, I mean, so can you put into words, and I'm not putting you on the spot here because I'm not sure that I could, but is it just the size of the thing, or is there a proportionality to it, or is there something offensive in the detail? Can you sort of say what it is about that grill that you dislike so much?
Okay, well, I will answer that in a moment. I think actually I can't put my finger on it necessarily. To me, it just looks so ugly. I've not really interrogated it any more than that. But actually, what I find frustrating is BMW's approach to design at the moment, intentionally trying to be divisive. There's this quote that was published in Car Magazine last year from BMW's head of brand design. He's talking about being divisive, about design that divides opinion, okay? And he says, if you want to make recognizable design, you have to do this to polarize, because good design is about a very strong and unique character. It's not about beauty. So he's saying that, exactly, he's saying there that cars, a well-designed car isn't beautiful, it's divisive.
But I mean, I could design, because I'm a really rubbish designer, I could design a really ugly car. It would stand out. Everybody would notice it. It wouldn't make it a well-designed car.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I absolutely refute the point that to create character, to create individuality, design has to be divisive. And, you know, the car that I compared it to, or the company that I compared it to in that post on DN was Polestar, which for me is, perhaps more so than anybody else at the moment, is showing how classical, beautiful, understated design can stand out, can create individuality and character.
Absolutely.
And you put those two cars side by side and there's just no competition. The other thing that I want to add to all of this is that, quite brilliantly, and I loved watching this unfold, was that car design superstar Frank Stephenson, because sort of weighed in the comments section on that post. And what I noticed first of all was that he was responding to everybody who was agreeing with my point of view. He was basically just replying with a whole stream of emojis, which was just brilliant to watch. And then he actually wrote a comment in response to somebody else, which I'll read to you now. He said,
just before you do that, can we just say, just for anybody who doesn't know, Frank Stephenson, he's a really, really nice bloke, but in design terms, he designed everything from, you know, the first of this, of the sort of BMW Minis to the McLaren P1. I mean, he's just the man. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. His work can be seen everywhere. And he literally wrote this in a comment in response to a DN follower. He said, the geometric design of the kidney grille clashes with the organic design of the body. I get the feeling that different designers worked on this car and none of them liked or agreed with each other. Which is, and actually, I mean, that was a bit of a sort of eureka moment for me when I read it, because, yeah, that ugly, brash, bold geometric grille does sit pretty uncomfortably on the front of a fairly sort of, actually derivative, but organic and smooth, edged body.
I think one of the sadnesses, I may be in a minority of one here, but I actually think the rest of the car looks quite good. And I think that there was an opportunity to do, I mean, to me, it's the most distinctive 4 Series that we've seen, largely for the wrong reasons out the front. But the rest of it, I think it's certainly a fluent and proficient piece of design. And he's absolutely right, of course. Of course, he's right. He's Frank, isn't he? But it is extraordinary, and it's like, to me, it smacks of some kind of insecurity. It's like, well, we're BMW, and what's BMW most famous for? Well, it's most famous for that grille. So we'll just make it bigger, and then people will think, yeah, that's a BMW. That's how we make people recognise what we do. Not by making beautifully proportioned, elegant cars. You know, if you look at the Polestar, you know, you can see an entire design language in that, which they will go on and develop and evolve, and everybody will know a Polestar when they see one. You don't need to put two great teeth on the front of it like that. And it's just sad, I think.
It just suggests to me that BMW have sort of run out of ideas. On the Polestar point, you can see, and also in modern Volvos, you can see a very clear and cohesive sort of objective when they set out to design those cars. You'll hate this word, but there's a very clear and distinct language. Whereas with lots of the German stuff that I'm seeing at the moment, BMWs in particular, but also certain modern Audis, it's as though they don't have a very clear idea, and so they just keep designing, keep doing a bit more here, a bit more there, and you end up with these sort of conflicting, quite fussy cars. And I feel like I'm seeing more and more of that stuff at the moment. I just want to do a little bit of sort of horn tooting at the moment, because the fact that Stephenson weighed in on that conversation, I think, is one of the reasons that I love doing DN so much, because it's out there in the sort of public domain where these industry figures exist. It's on Instagram. And so you won't get someone like Frank Stephenson signing up to an internet forum to respond to a stream of comments, or you won't get a guy like that signing up for a website to respond to an article. But because these guys are already on Instagram, spending time there, it's quite natural for them to come over to DN and respond to what we have to say.
I think it says a lot about the DN audience too. I think that people like him, I hope at least, identify, sometimes, if you go on, without naming names, other magazine websites, and you look at the comments, they just seem to be forums for people to hurl abuse at each other and to say, no, you're completely wrong about that, or that's rubbish, or, you're thick or whatever. And, we are so lucky. We just don't get that. We just get, properly enthusiastic, like-minded individuals who just love talking about, about the cars that we love. And I think, and I hope, that's why, somebody with his profile is happy to, just be out there and among this lot, because he identifies kindred spirits. And it's, as you say, it's one of the absolute best things about DN. It's basically got nothing to do with you or me.
Yeah, I think we sort of accepted that a little while ago, didn't we? Well, there we go. It should be its own thing, though, shouldn't it, with its own momentum? Right, okay. Well, let's move on to one final post. Andrew, you wrote a piece about homologation specials and how they very often make the best performance road cars.
Yeah.
But actually, what I want to ask you about is the car that inspired that post, because you spent a day driving it last week sometime, and that's that gorgeous Alfa Romeo GTA.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably enjoy driving anything at the moment. But so the GTA, it was just something that, I hadn't talked about it much because it was just something that came out of the blue. And I got to do this journey in it pretty much across England. And I've just loved GTAs. When you look on the internet at, great homologation specials, they never come up. Everybody talks about, everything from RS200 Fords to Integrales and, all the other cars that we know, and E30 M3s and so on, and rightly so. But it's one of the very first and one of the very greatest. And what I find so fascinating about it is just the extent that Alfa Romeo went to turn it, to make it homologation ready. So this, if people don't know, was a car that Alfa Romeo built in 1965 and 66. They only made 500 of them because that was the number that they were required to homologate the racing version. And it was based on the lovely, beautiful steel-bodied Giulia Sprint. But they just did, so they completely rebodied the thing in aluminium and pop riveted it all together. The inner body was made out of steel, but it's made out of specially thin steel. They put in Perspex windows. They developed a twin plug cylinder head for it. They've used mad stuff like it's got magnesium wheels, magnesium sump, magnesium bell housing, magnesium cam covers. It's got different door handle. It had bespoke suspension, brakes, just the whole thing. They've just gone through it from end to end. And when you look at it, it just looks like a Giulia Sprint GT. And if you don't know, you'll know soon enough when you get in it, because it weighs about 750 kilos. And, you know, the race versions have 170, 180 horsepower these days. In standard street version, it had, 115 horsepower, which, whatever it was, 55 years ago, in a car that light was just amazing. And to drive it, it's everything I want an Alfa Romeo to be. It's beautiful, it's light, it's delicate, it's massively responsive. The feel you get from it, the steering, you've got that amazing twin cam engine up the front. The balance of the thing, the rear suspension actually is kind of all wrong geometrically. What it does mean is you spend a lot of your time going sideways as well. And that's never boring. It's just beautiful and brilliant and rare and special. And yeah, so lucky.
Who was it that described the GTA as a not very poor man's Ferrari 250 GTO?
I don't know, but they were right.
There's something in it, isn't there?
I think it probably is. I've always thought of it, funnily enough, as being a not very poor man's short wheelbase. But yes, it's yeah, something okay. like that, isn't it? You get. I mean, I would think point to point, it would scare a short wheelbase witless. I think you'd need to drive a 250 short wheelbase, a standard steel short wheelbase, very rapidly indeed to get away from a well-driven GTA. But what I love about it is it's broadening this out to all homologation specials. You know, we all know of, you know, mad homologation specials like, you know, the road going Nissan R390 or the Toyota GT1 or the Porsche GT1, but those aren't, to me, homologation specials where cars get made in quantities of one or less than 10. To me, the great homologation specials are cars like the GTA where the base unit is a normal car. Be that car a 911 with the case of the 2.7 RS or an E30 M3 or an Alfa Giulia Sprint or a Ford Sierra. To me, that's where the magic of the homologation GT lies.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree. And you ended that post, much to many people's surprise, actually, looking at the comments, by talking about a Toyota Yaris.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I was being a little bit provocative, but, you know, I mean, just because, you know, these cars have become revered in the past, we can't be sniffy about the future and just go, because it's not one of them, because it's ahead rather than behind, therefore, and it's, you know, and it's a Toyota Yaris, you know, therefore it's going to be... it's going to be rubbish, or it's not going to be as good, or at some stage in the future when we look back on it, you know, it's never going to get on any of those lists. None of us have driven it. None of us know. You know, let's find out.
Yeah, so for people who aren't necessarily aware, this is the Toyota GR Yaris that's been announced, and I think it's due to reach the first owners later on this year, I think. It's a four-wheel drive Yaris with a turbocharged engine, I think about 260 horsepower.
Exactly right.
A manual gearbox. And you can have LSDs in both axles if you spec the right option pack. And it does seem to be genuinely a homologation car for Toyota's World Rally Championship Assault. And it's been so long since there's been any showroom model that has anything at all really to do with a proper WRC car. Geeks like you and I, Andrew, we're just sort of beside ourselves with excitement for this thing.
Yeah, but also it just smells right. You know, if you look at, you know, at the option packs and the spec and the, you know, and the crazy differentials you get, you know, the options aren't sort of, you know, whether you have active or passive cruise control or, you know, or air conditioning or climate control. This is proper weapons grade stuff, and all of that just, you know, they're either playing a blinder, or this is a car that, you know, means business. And until I'm perverted with incontrovertible evidence to the contrary, I'm going to hope it's that.
Oh God, I'm so looking forward to driving it. I hope that happens soon. Oh good. Well, there we go. Let's leave that one there. Before we go anywhere, just a quick reminder to all you lovely lot listening that if you want to, if you feel like it's worth your time and your money, please do head to patreon.com/drivenation, where you'll be able to pledge as much or as little money as you like each month to help support DN's growth, essentially. We've got big ambitions for this thing. We really want to take it places. We want to do more with it. We want to bring in other voices as well. And a small contribution each month will really help that to happen.
Help it happen, and it will speed up the rates. I mean, yeah, we like all freelance journalists, have, you know, two problems of time and money, and there's never enough of either. And any help you can give us with one will shorten the amount of the other that we need to take, and it'll just make better stuff happen sooner. It is as simple as that.
And there is some exclusive patron-only content in it for everybody who does contribute. So that's patreon.com/DriveNation. Right, well, let's leave that one there, Andrew. That was good fun. And to everybody listening, we'll talk to you again this time next week.
Look forward to it very much. All the best to everyone. I'll catch up with you then.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.